According to U.S. Department of Justice statistics, one out of every three girls and one of every six boys will be the victim of a sexual offense before they reach 18. Sex crimes are obviously a serious problem in this country, but according to a recent report by Human Rights Watch, our sex offender laws aren't working. With me now are Sarah Tofte of Human Rights Watch, also Linda, who runs a support group for the family members of sex offenders, and later we'll be joined by a doctor who works with sex offenders, Professor Elizabeth Letourneau. And I'm very pleased to welcome you to the show.
Thank you.
And,
thank you.
And Sarah, can you tell us how the current sex offender registration system works?
Sure. I'll try to make it simple. In about 1994, Congress passed a law called the Jacob Wetterling Act that for the first time required states to register sexually violent offenders for a period of 10 years. And so states adopted those registration laws. A year later, Megan's Law was passed by Congress, which requires community notification. And today, every state has an online registry where they can learn about convicted sex offenders living in their community. And sometimes
the names, photos, and addresses?
Their names, photos, addresses, usually the statutory name of their crime. And I'll get into more details later. I'm just giving you a basic outline of the laws. So those are the community notification laws. Police also are authorized to do community notification. So they could either some just put sex offenders online. Others do targeted community notification. They go into the neighborhood and they talk to communities about someone who's about to be released into their community. And then we have residency restriction laws. 20 states have residency restriction laws, which prohibit registered sex offenders from living within a certain distance from places where children gather. And that's the lay of the land, or at least those are the laws that we looked at in our report.
Well, aren't those good ideas? Shouldn't we have the right to know when a registered sex offender is living next door so we can warn our kids and to keep a closer eye on what's happening next door? Or, for that matter, what's happening at the local schoolyard.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that I think a lot of people assume it would help. It could help prevent sexual violence and protect our kids if we just knew which convicted sex offenders were living where. Understandably, after the murder of Megan Kanka in New Jersey by her next door neighbor, who was a previously convicted sex offender and whose parents said they didn't know that he was a convicted sex offender. If they did, they would have. Megan would still be alive today. And I think there's a lot. That's a very powerful argument and probably true. What's happened though is state legislators sort of adopted this idea of community notification, I think without doing a whole lot of research into will they actually prevent sexual violence? And are previously convicted sex offenders, do they always pose a risk to the community?
Well, part of the problem for me is I'm not exactly sure what a sex offender is. You talked initially about the law involving sexually violent offenders. Mm-hmm. Are they the ones who are put on these, on these websites?
And like I said before, originally, federal law at least limited they applied these kinds of sex offender laws to sexually violent offenders. And now the latest federal law that's been enacted is called the Adam Walsh Act, and states are going to have to implement this in 2009 or lose a portion of their federal law enforcement grant money. The Adam Walsh Act really greatly expands the federal mandatory minimum of who's considered a sex offender and how long they have to be on the registry. For the first time, it includes juveniles. So if you committed a sex crime when you're age 14 or older, you need to be on a registry and placed online. They really expand beyond just someone who's committed a sexually violent offense to include a lot of other kind of offenses.
Like urinating in public.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Adam Walsh Act doesn't go quite that far, but a number of states did, because these federal laws set a minimum for states that they a minimum compliance requirement. But most states went beyond that. And I think in some ways thought it would just be easier if we just put anyone convicted of a crime involving some sort of act that you could sort of connect with sex, like public exposure, public urination.
Are sex offenders on the list classified according to the nature of their crime? For example, if someone was convicted of consensual teen sex, is that person equal to somebody who is a repeat pedophile?
It depends on the state. Right now, there are some states that treat all convicted sex offenders the same. Basically, they put everyone on the registry, and they require everyone to be online. And so someone who's had consensual sex may be on the same online registry of someone who has been convicted multiple times of molesting a child. And for us, you know, one of our big concerns was, you know, there are a lot of consequences to being placed on an online registry. But also, it makes these tools, if there's any meaning, public safety value to these tools, it gets diluted by the fact that we just have so many people on these registries that probably may never pose a risk to the community or may not no longer pose a risk to the community. And for us, it was important that if we're going to have online registries, we need to limit them to include those that are actually assessed to be a high risk to the community.
Let's bring Linda in here. Linda, what kinds of crimes do the family members of people in your support group say that their family members have been accused of?
Well, it varies, just like the offenders themselves do. Everything from consensual sex underage to molestation of a family member.
In some cases, it is a very serious crime. In other cases, you would say it's not a serious crime?
Not serious in the terms of that they need to be on a registry. I mean, a lot of these are young people experimenting their sexual identities.
Are these offender lists maintained? Are they kept up to date? What is the likelihood that when I go to one of these registries that I will know how long ago the crime was committed?
Again, that depends on the state.
You know, that if I could just jump in for a second, I think that is another concern is some states do a good job of keeping the information up to date. For example, Vermont really limits who's going to be placed online. They only place what they call Tier 3 offenders, which are sexually violent. It's not simply just offense-based. I mean, it's the kind of offense they committed. It's their offending pattern, their response to treatment. They put these individuals online, and it's a lot easier to then keep track of and keep updated information about, you know, a small number of individuals. I think they have about 300 people online versus other states. If they put every registered offender online, you literally have thousands, sometimes tens of thousands of people to try to keep track of. And again, we just don't have the law enforcement resources to keep track of that many people.
My guests are Sarah Tofte of Human Rights Watch, and also Linda, who runs a support group for the family members of sex offenders. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Linda, are you suggesting that the family members of sex offenders are victims of these registries as well?
I can speak for myself at that. And having my husband be on a sex offender registry literally eats at my very soul. It's the first thing I think about in the morning, and it's the last thing I think about when I go to bed. We have been ostracized. We have been shamed and shunned. And we're good people.
Well, part of the problem, and we'll get into this later when we bring Dr. Letourneau into this conversation, is that the general assumption is that sex offenders are recidivists, that they feel such a compulsion to commit these kinds of crimes that they can't stop. Somebody comes out of prison after having served years for rape and within an hour raped somebody. So I don't know what your husband did, and I suspect you don't really want to talk much about that. But isn't that something that you have to be aware of?
You need to make yourself aware of the actual statistics. What you just cited is a myth. The recidivism rate for sexual offenders is really pretty low. I'm sure Sarah could give you the exact statistic on that.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, what are the statistics?
Yeah, you know, I think like a lot of people before I started this report, I assumed that most sex offenders would go on to commit another sex crime.
Because that's what we read in the newspaper.
Exactly, and it's what...
They let him out, and he did it again.
Of course, and those stories are sort of dominate in the media. And I also assumed, I think, that children were at probably greatest risk from strangers. And I was very surprised when I looked at the statistics that we, our own government has, the Department of Justice, DOJ statistics, Bureau of Justice statistics, the BJS, and other authoritative studies that have been done show that, in general, you know, 3 out of 4 convicted sex offenders do not go on to recidivate. And about 90% of sex crimes against kids are committed by someone the child knows or trusts or love. It's often happening within the home. And if I could say something quickly about the recidivism.
I mean, family members are much more likely to do this than some pedophile.
Than a stranger. And another thing I want to say is that this is a number that always strikes me that I think people don't pick up on as much. But to me, I find this the most striking number is that every year of all new sex crimes, 87% of new sex crimes are committed by someone who has no previous sex crimes conviction. So, you know, our purpose partly with this report was to look at sex offender laws, see what the consequences have been for convicted sex offenders, see if there are any public safety consequences, but also to say, you know, we're spending a lot of time and energy and resources on focusing on previously convicted sex offenders. Now, some of them pose a risk to the community, and we have to do a better job of figuring out who those people are and make sure they don't reoffend, that they're being monitored in the right way, being treated, getting treatment and things like that. But we also feel like there has to be some sort of public shift or focus to this 87% of sex crimes, you know, that are committed by someone with no previous sex crimes convictions. And in that sense, having all these laws are going to do very little to prevent sexual violence, you know, when you're looking at the fuller picture. And that was a significant concern of ours and one of our driving and motivating factors for releasing this report.
Linda, have you or people you know been put in danger because they've seen a family member on the sex offender registry?
Oh, yeah, most definitely. I have a link on my blog. It's called eAdvocate, and there's quite a few murders. Not too long ago, a woman in Tennessee that was married to a sex offender was killed in a fire that Vigiliani set. It's happening more and more. In fact, myself, I'm on the receiving end of a Vigiliani attack.
You mean somebody in the neighborhood thinks that...
Mine's online because I'm speaking out about this issue.
Mm-hmm. What about getting jobs? Yesterday we spoke to people who had been exonerated of crimes, and they have a hard time getting jobs because they have spent a fair amount of their lives in prison, wrongfully convicted in those cases. But the same thing applies to people who have been convicted of crimes. And then if you're on a registry, doesn't it make it even harder?
My husband lost his job, and he has been out of work now almost 2 years. He cannot get a job, and that happens more and more and more in my support groups. These men have children. What about the children of sex offenders? These kids are being harassed. They're being bullied. They're beaten up at school. They're ostracized. What about those children?
Sarah, I think I read in your report about a teenager who flashed some girls as a prank and was put on the list and then wound up committing suicide because of the impact it had had on his life.
Yeah, we in our report, we interviewed around 200 either previously convicted sex offenders or their loved ones. And I have to say the stories were all sort of sadly the same. I didn't talk to anyone who had not experienced some form of harassment or ostracism. Many of them end up unemployed because a lot of people check the online registry. And you're talking about, again, people who've committed low-level offenses. You're talking about kids that are placed on the registry who get their names Googled, and so everyone at school knows or believes them to be a dangerous sex offender. And so the consequences really can be devastating. And I think there are a lot of people who might say, you know, I don't really care about what happens to someone who molested a child. But, you know, for us, the important thing is that, you know, a lot of studies show we know with any kind of former offender, successful reentry is key to them, you know, to stop them from reoffending. And so when we talk about helping a previously convicted sex offender successfully reenter the community, we're talking about it in terms of public safety, that when they successfully reenter, then you have no more reoffending.
We have a call from Anne, who was a victim of a sex crime. Hi, Anne, you're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to speak to the issue of registries. I am the mother of a boy who was sexually molested when he was 6. And I agree that the whole idea of sex registries is absolutely counter to both the interests of society and to the offenders. If what we really want is to diminish the rates of sexual assault on children, then what we want is to find a way to get meaningful assistance to sex offenders, to reintegrate them into the community. And having their names on a list that targets them and tarnishes and diminishes the ability to do this seems to me a total act of paranoia.
Do you want to respond? Obviously, you both agree with her. I don't know how many other people whose sons have been victims of sex crimes would agree with Anne, but Anne, how have you come to this conclusion?
Well, I initially thought that it was a good idea. And then I realized two things. As a feminist, I know probably a half a dozen women who were sexually molested by their fathers when they were children. And no registry in the world would counter that. And it is, in fact, much more a family problem. This myth of the stranger wandering the neighborhood is pretty much a very low percentage. Now, my son was, in fact, molested by a stranger who had stalked him in a playground. But having that man's name on a list, I don't think would have diminished his ability to molest other children. The police knew who he was. They had a good description of him. They had circulated that description in the neighborhood, and yet it took 2 years for him to be caught. Having him on a sex registry wouldn't have changed that at all. And in fact, it might have made him less likely to seek help if he had been inclined to seek help.
And I have to go to a break now. Thank you so much for calling us. And we invite the rest of you, anyone who wants to weigh in on this, to leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Tell us if you think the sex offender laws are working or if you have personal experiences with those laws. And if you would like to check out Linda's blog, that's also linked to our show page at WNYC.org. It's called There Is Life After Sexual Abuse. We will continue our conversation with Linda and with Sarah Tofte of the Human Rights Watch, and we will be joined by Dr. Elizabeth Letourneau as we continue this show. We're back with Sarah Tofte of Human Rights Watch, Linda, who runs a support group for the family members of sex offenders. And we are joined now by Dr. Elizabeth Letourneau. She works with sex offenders and is associate professor of the Family Services Research Center at the Medical University of South Carolina. Hi, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks.
How successful have sex offender rehabilitation programs been over the years?
They are better than nothing. Research is pretty clear on that. The level of improvement that you see varies from offender to offender. One thing we know is that many offenders are at very low risk for reoffending, and so as a field, we would like to see institutions move towards treating higher risk offenders.
And how do you separate one from the other? Are there ways of spotting the most dangerous people?
There are for adults. For juveniles, it's much less clear cut. For adult offenders, we have reasonably good risk assessment measures, they're called, and they're actuarial-based. They're based on specific characteristics, and they have pretty good predictive validity. So they let us know which offenders are at highest risk for reoffending. And unfortunately, a lot of registration and community notification policies are not based on risk per se, but rather the type of offense that includes the Sex Offender Registration and Notification Act that was passed in the summer of 2006, or the Adam Walsh Act, as it's also known, where rather than relying on significant interventions for the most high-risk offenders, they apply to offenders based on the criminal offense committed.
Is it easier to spot the ones who are likely to be recidivists because they were victims of sexual abuse themselves when they were kids?
Sexual abuse and physical abuse, indeed childhood neglect in general, are risk factors for engaging in sexually offensive behaviors. Those are risk factors for a lot of harmful effects. So being a sexual assault victim, being a physical assault victim, being a victim of neglect or exposed to violence increases the risk for children of a number of harmful effects, including delinquent behavior, criminal behavior, and sexually criminal behavior. The great majority of victims of sexual offenses never go on to commit them, and if that were the case, most of our sex offenders would be girls, right? Because most of our victims mm-hmm. are girls. So most kids who are offended against, and certainly most adults who are offended against, don't turn into sex offenders. There's not a direct path there at all. There seem to be a variety of pathways towards becoming an offender and desisting from being an offender. For juvenile sex offenders, we have very good evidence from multiple randomized clinical trials that a home-based intervention is very successful at reducing later risk for reoffending, both sexual reoffending and non-reoffending, and improving youth mental health, youth scholastic achievements, peer relationships, family relationships. So we know that when we're able to affect change in those areas, peers, families, school, that we can get changes in delinquent behavior and criminal behavior.
Linda, what kind of rehabilitation programs have you seen offenders go through?
What I have found in my experience is that offenders that get individual and group counseling have the best chances.
Mm. Elizabeth, is that your feeling as well? I know you you work mostly with juvenile sex offenders, people under the age of 18. Are they more likely to be able to be turned around or less likely to have recidivist tendencies in the first place?
That's absolutely right. Juveniles are at very low risk for reoffending. So most studies find between 5 and 10% of juveniles who have committed a sex offense ever are arrested or convicted of committing another one. And those include studies with very long follow-up periods. And so it does not appear to be the case that we're missing large groups of kids who are reoffending, but rather that we identify kids as sex offenders who really are not going to reoffend. They offended perhaps out of naivety, out of exploration, out of hanging out with other delinquent peers, for a variety of reasons that are not terribly difficult to intervene with if you use sound, scientific-based intervention policies. I am familiar with adult offending as well. And there, the type of intervention with the most support is cognitive behavioral interventions that really focus on looking at some of the cognitions that resulted in offenders giving themselves permission to offend and how to alter those, as well as trying to reduce deviant sexual arousal when such arousal is present. It doesn't seem to be a factor for juveniles for most juveniles, but for adult offenders, those who have deviant sexual arousal are at risk for increased risk for reoffending, and those who score high on a measure of psychopathy, which is a measure of lack of empathy for others, placing one's own wants and needs above other people's, not responding to criticism or punishment very well. So individuals that score high on that and individuals that have high deviant sexual arousal, for example, sexual arousal to children, are at the greatest risk of reoffending for adult offenders.
Well, what do we do with them? There have been some suggestions that we just keep them in prison forever. After they serve their time and we release them and we know that they have there's a strong possibility that that these individuals, anyway, will do the same thing again. How does society cope with that kind of situation?
Well, there's a number of ways that we cope with it now, and certainly some people are kept in prison for forever. And there's more and more policies that attempt to do that or succeed in keeping people in prison or in civil commitment. So states have civil commitment options now. Most states where they're able to continue to lock up individuals beyond their incarceration periods. And those kinds of interventions might actually be appropriate for very, very high-risk offenders, offenders who say they're going to reoffend, offenders who have high deviant sexual arousal, high rates of psychopathy. The combination of those two is particularly potent.
Wait, civil commitment means after you have been committed on a criminal level, you are now kept on a civil level?
Yeah, so you can be evaluated at the end of your criminal, at the end of your incarceration, and if you're found to be, many of the states call these sexually violent predators or sexually violent perpetrators, SVP laws, you can be committed to a civil setting. Typically, it's a very high security, not really much different from prison, although they cannot be in prisons, for indeterminate periods of time. And so many, and I think actually it's still the case, that most people who are committed to civil commitment facilities have to sue to get their way out, that it's not very often the case that these individuals are released because the treatment team feels that they're ready to be released.
Sarah, what are your feelings about civil commitment and some of the other things we've been discussing?
Well, our report didn't look at civil commitment laws, and that is a whole other issue, and that's something that...
Well, Human Rights Watch would be concerned with that sort of thing.
In the sense that, there are some states who have, I think, have a little more narrowly constructed civil commitment law, so it does, that does apply to just those that are really the very, very few who are just such a high risk that we can't release them into the community.
And you wouldn't want to see them released.
And we wouldn't want to see them released. But I think that, when some states are not, their civil commitment laws are more expansive, and some people are starting to worry that it'll be a way for the state to keep convicted sex offenders detained indefinitely, and including those who may actually be able to be released into the community and not pose a risk.
Now, sometimes these stories make the newspapers, especially when we're talking about kids. Gennaro Wilson spent more than 2 years in jail for a teen sex conviction, even though it was consensual. And now the tabloids are abuzz with news that Britney Spears' 16-year-old sister is pregnant. The father is a 19-year-old. Technically, that's statutory rape, isn't it? Is that a sex crime?
It could be. I'm trying to remember, depending on, if it happened in Louisiana or California, states differ about that. But certainly. I mean, this is in the news a lot. I think the issue, we talk about sex a lot in the news, and we talk about sexual violence. Unfortunately, I think, Gennaro Wilson was sort of the exception, a case that got a lot of attention for various reasons. But for the most part, we do sort of focus on sort of anomalous cases, horrific cases, where a child is raped and murdered by a stranger who was a previously convicted sex offender. And again, that's just really not the sort of everyday reality of sexual violence. And for whatever reasons, we're not good as a society, as the public, as the media at talking about the real nature of sexual violence in this country.
Now, Linda, what happens when you watch a show like Law and Order's Special Victims Unit? Do you have a reaction to that? Do you think that affects the way people see you and your situation?
Oh, most definitely. There's so much mistruths and lies out there that it just feeds into it.
By the way, we're informed that the Georgia Supreme Court unanimously struck down a state law Wednesday that limited where registered sex offenders could live, ruling that the statute was so restrictive it unconstitutionally deprived the offenders of their property rights.
I think that actually was very recent.
Yeah, that was DeKalb County, where now there is a map that was provided. There's almost no place in DeKalb County where an offender can actually live.
Yeah, and you know, on the issue with residency restrictions, I think there is a fair amount of room for argument that on some limited level, registration and community notification may protect public safety. But with residency restrictions, what's interesting for us is that we have a lot of unusual allies who support the conclusions we made about residency restrictions, that they really do more harm than good. They isolate former offenders. There's no evidence that residential proximity, blanket restrictions like that have anything to do are a factor in sort of reoffending patterns. And that if you're going to have residential restrictions, you know, there's some individuals who may need to be restricted in where they live, but as a blanket law, they're not very great. And you'll hear that from law enforcement officials in Georgia. In fact, you had law enforcement officials who came out and said, this is making our community less safe. You'll hear that from child safety experts and anti-violence experts too. So residency restrictions, you know, I think a lot of people agree they're just really bad public policy.
We have a caller, Tom, from Staten Island, who has some thoughts on this based on personal experience. Hi, Tom.
I can't talk with you. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. Tom is a parole officer, and we thought that we'd get something, another perspective on this. The New York Times reported this past summer that juvenile sex offenses are on the rise, Dr. Letourneau. So is that becoming a more serious problem in this country? And have any sense of why this rise is occurring?
Yeah, sex offenses and all serious offenses or violent offenses fluctuate over time. And if you go back and look, starting in the 1960s and the 70s, when data were really being accumulated reliably in the United States, there are peaks and valleys. And in point of fact, from about the early to mid-1990s, sexual offenses in particular, but violent offending in general, declined dramatically. And that was that these declines tended to predate registration and notification types of policies, and so they're not due to those policies. These are declines that were occurring already. And so if there is an increase in juvenile offending that was noted, I think, just in the past year. And so, I don't think anyone right now is willing to say there's a trend even appearing, because when you look at any individual year, it can be a little bit above or a little below the previous year and not really mean that much. But you want to look at the broader trend. And the broader trend has been for adult and juvenile offending to decline. The past decade.
Well, we have very little time, but I want to ask each of you whether you think that we should eliminate these registries or whether there is a more sensible way of handling them. Let's start with you, Sarah.
Well, yes, you know, and our reporter recommendations were, you know, if you're going to have the registries, limit them, keep them in the hands of law enforcement. And if you do community notification, make sure it's targeted by law enforcement officials. And quickly, too, we also wanted to emphasize that if you're going to have these kinds of laws, have Congress invest in some funding to study, you know, their effectiveness and other ways that we could actually work to prevent sexual violence.
Linda, 15 seconds.
I want to piggyback what Sarah said. It should go to law enforcement. The public cannot handle the truth.
Dr. Letourneau?
I think juveniles should be removed from all community notification. That if registration is going to include juveniles, it should be limited to very short periods of time in the absence of new offenses. And for adult offenders, I would concur with Sarah that we need, I think registration makes good sense in many cases for higher risk offenders and when that information is kept in the hands of the police.
We have a link to the Human Rights Watch report on our show page at WNYC.org. If you want to read the full report, you can check that out. My great thanks to my three guests, Professor Elizabeth Letourneau, to Linda, and to Sarah Tufte of Human Rights Watch. It's been a fascinating discussion. By the way, there's a blog, a Human Rights Watch blog on this. Oh, Linda's blog. You can also go to that as well. Thank you all so much for being with us. On tomorrow's show, three of the original London cast members who are now starring in the Broadway production of Tom Stoppard's Rock and Roll. Also, we'll hear about the objects that have special meaning for our listeners, from a collection of chestnuts to a chocolate turkey from the 1970s, then the Posse Foundation, which has sent thousands of inner-city kids to college on full scholarships, and Please Explain is all about snow. Check out our New Year's food segment. You can send us your favorite New Year's recipes by going to our show page at WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blake Neeshick, Scott Goldberg, and Sarah English. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Tess Hartman and Tanya Wiedeking. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.